Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today in the program, we will visit some of the smaller towns where Black Lives Matter protests have occurred.
We don't exactly fit in with the general population of Du Bois. It's a really conservative town. We're both more radical, I guess you could say. Definitely more liberal.
It's been a scary time for undocumented workers.
And I understand for a lot of immigrant folks who are at risk for deportation, deportation could mean death.
And a town remains skeptical about COVID-19, despite being the county with the most cases.
They weren't staring down coronas that day. They were staring down a tyrannical government.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The nationwide wave of protests that has followed the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other Black Americans by police officers has reached all 50 states and every corner of Wyoming, including many small towns that have never seen protests before. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler and Savannah Marr have more.
Buffalo, Wyoming is well known as a small western town. The historic Occidental Hotel still stands on Main Street. Murals of horses paint the sides of old brick buildings. Buffalo's most widely attended event is a four-day-long festival that celebrates a fictional sheriff in a town based on Buffalo in Johnson County. But now, Buffalo is like the hundreds of cities and towns across the country holding protests against racial injustice in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by a police officer. Buffalo's march was formed by a small group of friends in town after attending a protest in neighboring Sheridan. Rowan Heil is one of them.
I figured, you know, if a young girl can organize that there, then why can't I do it here? And we figured, you know, why wait? This movement is now. This is happening. This is current. And so we organized it for a week in advance.
More than 50 protesters marched less than a mile from the Johnson County Justice Center to Crazy Woman Square in downtown Buffalo. When protesters arrived at the town square, they knelt in silence for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the length of time the officer held his knee on Floyd's neck on a Minneapolis street in late May, killing him. Protesters gave speeches that focused on the need to end racial injustice and address it, even in towns as small as Buffalo. 16-year-old Danica Boyce, who is biracial, says she sees this as her community stepping up.
I was just so ready for a change, because if it's happening in a large city and it trickles down this far, it's such an amazing thing, because not a lot of things get this far, get to the small communities over here. So the fact that it did is just such a monumentous feat. It's so amazing, and I'm so proud of my community for doing it.
And it's not just Wyoming that's seeing this change. Across the country, small towns that tend to sit out social justice movements are joining the conversation. Anne Helen Peterson has been writing about the phenomenon for BuzzFeed.
I first started looking at the demonstrations that were just happening outside of major cities.
Places like Portland, Maine, and the suburbs of Chicago. But she started seeing reports of massive crowds in some truly unexpected places.
The first one that I was like, holy crap, was Havre, Montana, which is just not a place where you would ever think that there would be a social justice protest.
You might say the same about Buffalo, Wyoming, or Torrington or Pinedale. But demonstrations in each of those small rural towns drew dozens of Wyomingites. Peterson says that kind of small-town participation is part of the reason this uprising feels different.
It's really emphasizing that this is a national movement. It's a global movement, but it's also a completely national movement. Not only at all 50 states, but every corner of every state. And that speaks to just how strongly people want change.
That resonates with Tessa Hoost and Kellen Chandler, who organized a small protest in tiny Du Bois, Wyoming. They just graduated from the town's high school with a class of 11 students, and Chandler says their politics have always set them apart.
We don't exactly fit in with the general population of Du Bois. It's a really conservative town. We're both more radical, I guess you could say. Definitely more liberal.
But they'd never actually attended a protest before.
No. I always put like on mini protest when I put on my Black Lives Matter sweatshirt.
And Hoost says even that didn't go over well. So they weren't expecting their neighbors to be on board with their demonstration.
But really, the support was pretty overwhelming. So we stood on a street corner, the only intersection in town. And so as people were driving by, we actually got a lot of like thumbs up and people honking.
One local family even got out of their car and protested alongside them. But others stopped to argue with them or shouted at them as they drove past. Chandler and Hoost say they know there are people in the community who disapprove of what they did and might even look down on them for it. And in a town of fewer than 1,000 people, your reputation sticks to you.
I did get like a couple people telling me like, don't do it, it'll ruin your reputation. And I was like, if my reputation is ruined, that's like literally not as big as people literally dying from police. It's really not a difficult choice.
In Buffalo, Rowan Heil is making the same calculation. She says she's been targeted and harassed since announcing on social media that she was helping organize the protest.
Some people threw trash in my backyard, honked outside at 1:30 a.m. I got a lot of negative Facebook messages, people thinking that they could convert me to All Lives Matter by sending me some dumbass videos. My friends got those as well from people that don't even know us, people that have never spoken to us personally, you know, making a judgment based off of one post that we made, you know, trying to stand in solidarity.
And while knowing everyone in town might make you a target for some hate, it can also have the opposite effect. Danica Boyce.
I felt like there's an energy in our little circle, just in our little group, that just made me feel comfortable enough and feel safe enough to speak out on my personal viewpoints mm-hmm. and how I feel.
I want for the right to be known as Danica Boyce, not the black girl in class. It really means a lot for the minorities here to be in Wyoming, to be known as me.
As Trump 2020.
So I just say thank you to you all, and that's all I got to say.
Boyce says while the support and experience mean a lot to hear, she knows it hasn't solved all of the problems in Buffalo and the country.
In Du Bois, Tess Hoost and Kellen Chandler say their small protest didn't change the world either, but it did help inspire another demonstration, a walk around a local pond in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And that event was organized by adults in the community.
I was just like, it was gobsmacked at how many people showed up. I was blown away because my whole life I've spent here, I'm just like, oh, can't wait to get out of here and like maybe meet some new people. But I'm just like, I don't know. It kind of makes me just want to stay.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr.
And I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Protests against racism and police brutality are not new to the U.S. or our region. However, large sustained turnout, especially in small, mostly white towns, is something we've never seen before. And for many of those protesters, it's been their first time demonstrating ever. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke to some of them in Laramie.
Back in 2012, when 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was killed in Florida, demonstrations broke out across the country. And then again, when the man who killed him was acquitted for murder.
They are Trayvon Martin.
Here in Laramie, students and faculty at the university demonstrated on campus, but it was only a few dozen people, and just for one day. Fast forward to now, and hundreds of Laramie residents have been protesting here against the police killings of people of color, with those protests going on for weeks now. On a recent night, people were marching up and down one of the town's main streets for 30 blocks. Celeste Peral is standing at a distance in a parking lot with a sign that says Black Lives Matter. She's protesting from there because she's high risk for COVID-19.
I have an autoimmune condition, so staying here is probably the best for me. So we brought some water to set out so everybody can grab some water and some signs to just kind of be here while also being safe.
This week has been her first time protesting. She's here with her friend Hannah Rimes, who attended some marches with her family as a teenager.
This is the first march that I've ever come out to and attended of my own volition and thought, okay, this is something that matters to me. I want to take a stand for this.
Both Rimes and Peral are white, and this spring they both graduated from the University of Wyoming. They say it was their college education that woke them up.
The past few years, I've had the privilege and honor of getting to know friends who are black and persons of color, and really getting to see their life experiences has changed my mind
And I will never understand what their life experience is like, but I can stand with them and demand justice.
Rhyme says this is not a political issue.
It's really important to me to emphasize that this is not a liberal issue, and nor is it a conservative issue. Like, demanding justice and accountability from our police force is not a political statement. It should just be something that we ask for as Americans.
A few cars down is Vince Schaff. He's also white, and he's here with his family.
Well, I think we're gonna join the walk once it gets up here, and so we've got two other people in the car as well, but not everybody is the most fit, so we figured this is maybe a good halfway point.
This is Schaff's first time demonstrating as well. It was his college-age son who brought this issue to the forefront for him. He says his son wanted to talk about race and white privilege.
He's been really active about sharing things that are important, and I think if more people that look like me, oftentimes in the media, you see bald guys with white beards who seem to be the problem.
Schaff hopes even more people will show up and protest because he says people of color should be able to do the same things as white people without having to worry.
Maybe taking a walk or jogging through a neighborhood or all those things. I never have to talk to my son about like how he dresses when he goes out at night, or if you get pulled over by a cop, you need to do those things. And so I just feel it's time that I need to be out here to be able to say those things, and I think that's important.
For at least one first-time protester here, the issue of race and policing has been an inescapable part of his life since he arrived in Laramie about 6 years ago.
It's time, you know. Something has to be done.
Hanson Yaus came to Laramie from Papua New Guinea for college. He says it hasn't always been easy to live here as a black man.
Police following you for no reason down the block, you know. You just try to go home, you know. They follow you like way too long, like, you know, come on, man, you're wasting taxpayers' money, you know, go do something else, you know.
Yaus says he's grateful to see so many white people turning up to support people of color.
It means a lot, you know, like, you know, you guys are together, you know, and, you know, it will make a difference.
Organizers of the protests say they are working on making a difference. They just met with Laramie City Manager to discuss a number of actions, including transparency at the local police department. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll talk about the census and why it matters. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Every 10 years, the U.S. Constitution mandates the government counts the people living in this country. That count factors into many aspects of our lives at the national, state, and local levels, including local funding for our communities. So far, Wyoming's self-response rate is 55%. But principal economist Amy Bittner with the Wyoming Economic Analysis Division says that is not a reason to worry right now. Bittner spoke to Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler about how Wyoming's response rate is stacking up against the rest of the country.
It is lower than the nation, and it is lower than other states. But, you know, some houses in Wyoming are just now receiving their questionnaires or their invites to respond to the census. And that's because
the way that houses receive their questionnaires, they either get it in the mail. For example, mine came in the mail and I filled it out. Or if you live in more rural parts of the state and maybe don't get mail at your house or get mail at a P.O. box, the way that the Census Bureau gets the questionnaire to you is they leave it on your door. And the whole COVID-19 virus thing shut down the Census Bureau's field operations. So they were supposed to go, hand deliver those questionnaires at those houses at the end of March, but they couldn't. And so they just now are resuming those operations. So some housing units have just now restarted receiving their census questionnaire.
And the rate right now, like you said, may be on the lower end compared to some of the other states, but that doesn't necessarily mean people are ignoring the census in Wyoming. As of right now, it's just the nature of how people live here.
Right. Like, I think there's about 67,000 housing units in Wyoming that receive their questionnaire left at their door. But on the flip side, people can respond to the census for, you know, their housing unit and the people that are living in their house without getting anything. Because this time around, for the 2020 census, people can respond online. And that wasn't an option before. This is the first time that you can respond online. So people can go to my2020census.gov, and they can respond online to the questionnaire. The invites that we received in the mail and the questionnaires that are left on people's doors, you do have a unique code. But you don't have to have that to fill it out online. It allows you to type in your address. If it recognizes your address, you can move forward with completing your questionnaire online. You can also call and complete your questionnaire via phone if maybe you don't have internet access or maybe you're not online savvy.
Are there any challenges to counting particular groups or people with the census?
There are typically certain populations that have historically been hard to count. People who move around a lot, housing units that have multiple families in it, housing units where maybe the people living there don't speak English very well. Maybe there's a different language spoken in that house. College students are sometimes difficult to count because they should be counted where they go to school, and maybe they think, oh, my parents will just count me on their census form. So, yeah, there are certain parts of our population that are deemed hard to count. Everybody should be counted who, you know, are living here regardless of citizenship, regardless of how many families are living in maybe one housing unit. You know, it's just important that everybody who is, you know, living in the state, who is living in the U.S., be counted.
Yeah, and I guess jumping off that point, why is it important to be able to count everyone where they live?
I think the thing that resonates most with people is maybe the dollar aspect. You know, federal funding is distributed based on population numbers. Even some of our state revenue, it is distributed based on the decennial count. When I say decennial count, that means the count every 10 years. It's important for communities, for planning purposes. People need to know the demographics of their communities, how many people are in their communities, to plan for, like, health care, for businesses, you know, to plan and determine maybe if they open a location in a certain area. You know, and I think the, you know, COVID-19 situation is a good example of that. Maybe it might resonate more with people because, you know, for emergency planning and getting funding. So the count that you get in 2020, that's the count that they'll use for the next 10 years. So you want to make sure you get it right.
So what are the next steps? How long do people have to respond to the census now?
It's not too late for people to answer their census form. Just because the Census Bureau has extended what they call the self-response, meaning people respond to the questionnaire themselves versus, you know, having an enumerator come out. So people can still fill out. They got a questionnaire left at their door. They can hand fill it out. They can still go online and complete it, and they can also call on the telephone. That period has been extended through October. But of course, the sooner the people do it, the better. The more people respond, the better response rate we get. And, you know, it saves from having to send census workers out, you know, which that will tentatively start, I think, around August, is when they will send out enumerators to go follow up at those households that haven't completed their survey. So even though it's past census day, April 1st, 2020, people still have plenty of time, you know, to complete their survey.
Amy Bittner is a principal economist with the State of Wyoming's Economic Analysis Division. Thank you, Amy, for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks. Bye.
So far, Laramie, Park, and Sheridan counties have the highest response rates in the state, while Teton and Sublette counties have the lowest. When we come back, we'll explore a new program that's designed to provide rental and mortgage assistance and how that's faring. And it's also a scary time for undocumented workers. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The pandemic has caused thousands of people to file for unemployment, but for many immigrant workers, that's not an option, even with the new Supreme Court ruling about DACA. And as Megan Feary reports, a recent federal rule discourages even those that could apply.
Ana Castro was born in Mexico City and crossed the border with her mother as a child using a coyote, a person who smuggles immigrants across the U.S. border for a fee.
We walked for days and nothing came of it. And my mom was 8 months pregnant at the time. And now as an adult, I just don't even comprehend how she did that.
Ana is undocumented and a DACA recipient. She lives with her fiancé in Laramie and managed to keep both her jobs during the pandemic, but couldn't work for 5 weeks, which created a real financial strain because Ana couldn't file for unemployment.
We've never had a savings account. We live paycheck to paycheck. There was a moment where our phones were disconnected because, like, we couldn't pay.
Undocumented workers pay millions of dollars in state and local taxes every year in Wyoming. Yet they can't apply for food stamps or unemployment, and the Supreme Court decision hasn't changed that. They recently issued a decision that extended DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. DACA recipients like Ana can renew their permits to work legally and not fear deportation, but that decision is only temporary and doesn't apply to all undocumented workers.
I still live in fear of what's going to happen, and it's really humbling.
It's estimated that nearly 4% of Wyoming's population are immigrants, with 1% being undocumented. And many have lost their jobs due to COVID-19. Some have had to rely on local nonprofits like food banks to get by. But not every county has the same number of resources. Ana says Albany County, where she lives, is the poorest county in the state.
In Spanish, we have the saying, "Es con dinero baila el perro." With money, even the dog dances. And then I feel like here on this end of the state, we are just constantly fighting for resources.
And Albany County has the highest food insecurity. Ana says even reaching out for help from nonprofits can be nerve-wracking. This fear is something felt by immigrants across the state. Antonio Serrano is the advocacy manager for the ACLU of Wyoming and a Latinx activist. He says that many immigrants are terrified to even go to the doctor.
Because they were scared. If they went, they might get ICE called on them. This is just next level because this is people's lives. And I understand for a lot of immigrant folks who are at risk for deportation, deportation could mean death.
In late March, the ACLU penned an open letter to Governor Mark Gordon and prison officials asking them to temporarily cease raids during the pandemic. ICE detainees are often held in local jails before moving to larger facilities. Serrano says this is dangerous.
It's horrible to have a family put apart by ICE, but it's even worse now. The jails are not safe. Then they're moving them from jail to jail across the county, and they're not helping prevent the spread by doing this.
It remains unclear if the raids have ceased, and the governor says it's a federal matter. Riley Ward is an immigration lawyer with Trifonis Law in Jackson. She says without a valid work visa, immigrants do not qualify for unemployment, and even those with a valid work visa may choose not to apply because of a new federal law, the public charge rule. It can disqualify people from obtaining legal status if they have a history of receiving certain kinds of public aid. Ward says it leaves families with a difficult choice.
Do we do everything we can to feed our family in the short run versus do we take steps to ensure that in the long run we're taking the best action for our potential, you know, immigration case?
The majority of immigrants in Wyoming work in food service, construction, agriculture, and on oil rigs. Though the exact number that have been let go since the start of the pandemic is unknown, Ward estimates it's likely quite high. She adds that while Teton County has more resources available, this comes with its own problems.
We have a great nonprofit network in Teton County. Our whole community is very blessed by that. However, I do think that this is absolutely an additional stress on that system.
Anna, the undocumented worker living in Laramie, says the decision gives her hope, but it's likely the Trump administration will try to end the DACA program again.
I wish people could imagine being left with nothing and no one to take care of you and provide for you, and being so desperate that you risk your life to find something better.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Megan Feary.
A new state program seeks to help Wyoming residents as many struggle to make rent or mortgage payments during the pandemic. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor reports the program is off to a slow start, but could grow more critical throughout the summer.
The Wyoming Emergency Housing Assistance Program was one of several measures passed by the state legislature to mitigate the economic impacts of COVID-19. The program will pay part of a resident's rent or mortgage payment if that resident was hurt financially by the pandemic.
We'll provide up to $2,000 per month of assistance to renters or homeowners to help assist in making those payments.
That's Scott Hoversland of the Wyoming Community Development Authority, an organization created by the state in the 70s to finance affordable housing. Now, the Development Authority is tasked with dispersing the payments to landlords and loan servicers. The program is backed by $15 million allocated from the $1.25 billion in federal funding Wyoming received from the CARES Act.
What we're trying to do is really cover everybody in Wyoming. Our WCDA programs are generally targeted at the low to moderate income, but you know, this pandemic has affected everybody.
The program won't pay all of your rent or all of your mortgage payment. Based on your income and housing bill, the exact payment will vary, but it could pay a significant chunk of that housing bill for the coming months. Hoversland says recipients must show that the pandemic caused a loss of income.
You know, either a reduction in income, loss of job, or they've had to stay home to care for an underage dependent because, you know, they don't have child care or those types of things, or they themselves have contracted COVID-19, and if they can demonstrate that, then they qualify.
As the state started locking down in mid-March of this year, life in Wyoming changed dramatically. As the state began social distancing, a record number of Wyomingites filed for unemployment, while others found their hours cut or their pay reduced. It became clear that many, especially low-income workers, were going to find it difficult to pay rent in the coming months. There was talk of a general rent strike around the country. Others began seriously discussing a ban on evictions, a measure put in place by more than 20 other states. Nate Martin of the group Better Wyoming wrote an op-ed calling on the governor to do just this. Martin says the new state program is a step in the right direction.
Is it a perfect solution? Probably not, but does a perfect solution exist for anything in, you know, this unprecedented crazy situation that we're living through? Again, probably not.
Martin says he'll be interested to see how successful the program is.
There's obviously more work to be done in terms of making sure people are okay and have their basic necessities covered during this crisis. But at this point, I don't know exactly what prescription to make.
The program is not the end-all be-all of rental assistance, however. And Martin says there will still be some people who lose their homes regardless.
And in the midst of a, you know, unprecedented budget shortfall that the state is experiencing, it's unclear how much federal money is going to keep coming down the pipeline. So eventually the faucet's going to run dry and the problems are probably going to remain.
Representative Mike Yin of Teton County voted in favor of the program. Yin has long taken an interest in housing, coming from the county with the highest income inequality and chronic housing problems.
We want to make sure that people stay in their homes and people stay in Wyoming. That's the goal. And if it does look like it's well used and that we'll need to refund it, that's something that the legislature will have to look at come next special session if we have one.
The program only launched earlier this month. So far, only a few residents have applied, just more than 100. And of that 100, less than 20 have received any assistance, although more applications are being processed. Applicants must meet certain requirements and provide relevant documentation. Hoversland said some applications on the site remain incomplete or abandoned. The total payments awarded so far come to about $26,000, far short of the available $15 million.
We've had another 31 that have been declined. A lot of that has to do with, you know, it was for prior months where they made their payment and they were asking for reimbursement. We can't reimburse under this program if they're not, you know, short that payment. It's not paying for back months that were paid.
But Hoversland says he expects the program to pick up steam as tenants and homeowners start staring down the barrel of rental or mortgage payments in July. Unemployment bonuses related to the coronavirus are also set to expire midsummer, meaning the assistance program could also gain more applicants going into August, and as word gets out about the program.
But we may see it reduced, too, if everybody starts gradually getting back to work.
State residents can apply for rent or mortgage payment assistance on the Development Authority's website. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Tourism is the second largest industry in the state. The summer of 2019 was a big year for the industry. Over $3 billion were spent in Wyoming, and tourism generated $230 million in tax revenues. Wyoming Office of Tourism Director Diane Schober says the state has set even loftier goals for 2020. But as Schober speaks with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska, she says this year, COVID-19 has hit tourism hard. But there's hope that things could improve.
So the good news is that the fundamental strategy hasn't changed, because Wyoming has always been wide open spaces, a road trip destination. And so this is a destination where people have always, for that, we don't have to change much. And that's good, because for destinations that do have to completely reinvent who they are and how they are, in this, for travelers in a COVID world, Wyoming doesn't have to do that. And still wide open spaces, not very many people, beautiful, outdoor national parks, dude ranches, state parks. So our product and the product experience didn't have to change. And so what we have done just in our shift in marketing is obviously timing of how we're flighting it, because we're not doing anything internationally right now. We've shifted some dollars into our domestic campaign so that we could focus on that road trip. And then we're launching at the 1st of July, an entire road trip campaign based on, we have routes, they're marketing routes, Salt to Stone, harnessing that whole west side of the state from Salt Lake, the Great Salt Lake, up to Yellowstone National Park, the Black to Yellow, which runs across the North Corridor, the Black Hills to Yellowstone. Park to Park is from Rocky Mountain National Park to Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. And then the Rockies to Tetons. And the reason why they've been in place for many years is because the inspiration for most people's travel to Wyoming is our national icons. But then how do you really elevate the road trip along the way to or from? And so we're enhancing a campaign specifically around those routes, which gives us more opportunity to really focus on local communities along those routes. And that is repurposed money. That was not originally planned to be in the marketing budget this year.
So it's definitely kind of refocused much more on the road trippers of America.
Yeah, yeah. Just putting more emphasis on it. And you hear it. I mean, you see, if you, you see any kinds of ads for car commercials or any, a lot of brands and products, consumer products, they're all talking about this. So it's nice to be able to just, put yourself in there where people are already thinking about it. And because it already has been a road trip destination.
Right. And so how has tourism looked since we reopened?
Well, I think better than expected in a COVID world. I mean, the economics right now are not showing that there's any increase. Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park, even through the first 10 days of June, we're at maybe 57, 60% of where they were a year ago. And certainly in terms of hotels and their occupancies and, you know, they're still not anywhere near where they were before. We're seeing an uptick, but yet not to levels that really, you know, we're still woefully behind where we were a year ago. And so there's a lot of room for opportunity for growth and development. And we just know by this, you know, think about in people who are maybe operating an Airbnb, they may need to have more space between guests so that they can have that kind of cleaning that they want to provide. In hotels, in a place like Yellowstone, where you need a large volume of employees, but you know, they're normally housed in dormitories. And if you know, there's some restrictions there on what you can actually open and what is available for overnight lodging. Some of the rafting companies have chosen not to operate this year because you can't social distance. And so in context, you know, we're moving, we're in a much better place than we thought we would be, even 30 days ago. But we still have a long way to go to get back to what we would call normal. And I don't anticipate that we'll see that. Hopefully we see it in 21 is what I'm hopeful for.
So it is looking like it will pick up going forward, but it won't be like pre-COVID numbers.
That's exactly. I don't even need a crystal ball for that. What we want to do is leverage this, pray that wildfires stay contained and that they don't, you know, there's other things that interrupt our tourism season in a normal year. And so we really don't need any further disruptions. And we want people to be safe out there. You know, one of the last things we want is more outbreaks of this. And we all, people have a responsibility to each other and to the experiences that they want. They may be slightly different under these circumstances, but they can still be really fulfilling and really enjoyable.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Diane. All right.
When we come back, a Jackson doctor says people can worry too much about COVID-19. We'll talk about that coming up on Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. We're starting to once again see more cases of COVID-19, and it's led to calls for wearing face coverings and social distancing. And while that's good, it's possible to be too worried about the virus. Jackson Dr. Brent Blue joins us to discuss what he's seen as Wyoming closes 3 months of the coronavirus.
There's certainly a significant amount of what the academics call compliance fatigue, where people are tired of being, you know, kept in their homes, or tired of social distancing and wearing masks and so on. So I think we're seeing a fair amount of that.
The thing that I see in Laramie, and I think some other people in the state have run into, is that not only are you correct about the fatigue on that, is that they've just kind of quit doing it, and that's led to, at least the Evanston situation, where we've seen a little bit of a blow up. I mean, do people just really have to focus on being vigilant about these things?
Well, I think that what is really important is people have to focus on their own individual health, and that means eating appropriately, exercising, getting enough sleep, staying hydrated, and doing everything they can to keep their own immune system healthy. the far majority of people who contract the COVID virus have minimal to no symptoms. And the people who tend to get the sickest are the people who have underlying conditions, especially obesity and diabetes and hypertension. So, when you talk about it, the average healthy 20-year-old, it's going to be hard to convince them that they need to do anything to maintain social distancing just because the virus is not going to be a significant factor for them. And, of course, the great advantage we have here in Wyoming is we have so much fresh air and open spaces that even with droplet spread, the amount of dispersion of those droplets is significant when you're outdoors and the air is blowing and so on.
When we were talking earlier in the week, you said something I found very interesting and I wanted to ask you about this, is that in some cases, maybe you've run into situations where people, their concern about COVID-19 might exceed reality a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about what you've encountered?
Well, I think that there's no question about the fact that the panic is going to cause more of a problem than the pandemic. And it's going to be with us for quite some time because it's creating a significant amount of anxiety in the public and neuroses in the public. I've had one person who was admitted for a bleeding ulcer who was a 32-year-old, otherwise healthy fellow, because he was so worried about contracting the virus and spreading it to his mother. I've had people call me up, and one woman who called me and asked me how to open a box that came to her home from UPS because she was afraid of contracting the virus from the box, which is really not a risk factor at all. And I mean, this anxiety is pretty dramatic, and it can be overwhelming for people. And we're seeing that. And then, of course, the other side of that, too, is that the effect on the economy when you have unemployment, the number of suicides goes up linearly with the amount of unemployment. So that's a significant risk that's going to be with us in the future. So I think it's very important for people to really think about what their real risk is and to talk to their healthcare professionals, talk to counselors, and learned how to deal with the real risk in a realistic way.
So I ask you, what should I be afraid of and what shouldn't I be afraid of?
That's always a difficult question because, I mean, the question is, are you afraid of the flu and are you afraid of getting a cold? And it's pretty similar to what you would have with the coronavirus. The reason the coronavirus or the COVID virus, I should say, which is a coronavirus and similar to the coronavirus that causes colds. The difference is that this virus has not been around before, so no one has natural immunity to it initially. And that's something that will build up over time in the population. To some extent, it's not a matter of if someone is going to eventually catch the COVID-19 virus, but when they're going to catch it. And as I was saying before, the most important thing is what we say to people all the time, and that is it's important to stay healthy and stay fit. And this should be a wake-up call for anyone who's overweight or who is not taking care of their health, who's not exercising and not eating right. I mean, you can't eat fast food every day and expect your immune system to be good.
I don't want to compare this to the flu, but at the same time, there does seem to be similarities with other viruses. If it's out there, normally we try to distance ourselves from other people. Is that your advice and not to like get too concerned about it, too anxious about it?
You know, people don't want to compare it to the flu, but when you look at the number of hospitalizations, even on the most recent numbers, the serious or critical cases is running about 1.5%. of the people who are tested positive. And that's probably even a lower percent when you think about the people who are positive who haven't been tested. And that's probably the majority of people in this country.
Dr. Brent Blue from Jackson, always a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. Pleasure.
Riverton has seemingly returned to normal from months of closed businesses, social distancing, and mask wearing. This while Fremont County has the highest number of COVID-19 cases and deaths in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner reports that some rules exist, but it remains to be seen if they'll be enforced.
Riverton Mayor Richard Gard says that people are happy to get back to work.
So I think there's a real pent-up desire to get back to what people view as their normal. And so if we're able to, and if the virus doesn't hold on and doesn't start back up, I think that we can get back fairly quickly.
Gard, who co-owns a company in the building industry, says he believes the government went too far in shutting down businesses and focusing on social distancing due to COVID-19. He says the drafters of the Constitution didn't consider something like a communicable disease in the document's creation.
The Constitution wasn't written with any clauses in it as to the Black Plague, but it was written to keep governments from running over the top of individuals, and they feared that much greater than a medical emergency. And they weren't staring down coronas that day. They were staring down a tyrannical government.
While other business owners may be pleased to get back to work, the question of how much of a choice Riverton's workforce has in returning to work is debatable. Many because of low wages and the inability to put money away for such an extreme circumstance must go back to work, whether they are worried about the coronavirus or not. Nashira Schmidt is a bartender at the Cedar Bar in Riverton. She's preparing to open up after weeks of cleaning the closed bar. Schmidt was given guidelines to safely open up, but nobody is enforcing them that she's aware.
No one is enforcing them. The mayor, he honestly in the meeting said, be adult, be responsible. If you're sick, stay home. You know, if you don't want to open and you're not comfortable, don't open. He's leaving it up to the business owners, you know.
One issue is that many customers aren't convinced that the coronavirus is a huge concern in their community. Mike Bailey owns the Pit Stop Convenience Centers in Riverton, Lander, and Dubois, as well as a tire center. Bailey isn't sure if some of his employees who had to quarantine had COVID or something else. But since they had to stay home, the business was down employees. So other workers picked up multiple shifts.
During one week, we were down 10 people. And so that made everybody else have to work harder and pick up the slack of the ones that were gone. And, you know, we were sort of running shorthanded. And again, that sort of stresses people out, too.
And stress isn't good for your immune system. Heightened stress at your job during a pandemic where customer service is the expectation makes wearing a mask seem important. But despite the spread of coronavirus in the county, many of Bailey's employees had an issue with the mask.
Yeah, it's a customer service kind of business. And so, you know, it's hard to see somebody smile or frown or whatever if they've got mask on. And a lot of people had trouble with the masks. They just couldn't breathe like they were supposed to. And, you know, so it was a little bit restrictive for people.
Another thing stressing people out is their personal bottom line. Lawrence Miles is working at a fuel center attached to a local grocery store. Outside his station is a gallon of hand sanitizer with a pump. His hours used to be consistent, but now his hours are reduced, despite being trained in multiple positions with the company.
Mom, Dad, and I bought a house about four blocks from Walmart.
Miles helps take care of his older parents at a house they're still paying off. On top of house payments and paying off federal student loans, he can't afford not to go to work. But he also worries about his older parents' health. Miles has his own theory as to why people in Riverton seem to not take COVID-19 guidelines seriously.
There does tend to be a bit more of like an isolation. We might be good because, you know, we're not a bigger city. Our lifestyle has pretty much been the same with just a few minor modifications.
With so much of life out of control for the working class, it's hard to see much choice for the people who must go to work. Miles says he's worried about a second wave, but there exists a lot of uncertainty.
We're just kind of playing it by ear, listening to what managers and them through the corporations are telling us, keeping an eye on the news, and we're all just kind of in it together. Second wave, if it does come, hopefully it's not as bad, but the likelihood of that, I don't know. I guess we will find out.
State health officials are planning on keeping the economy rolling, but they are urging businesses and members of the public to wear face coverings and social distance in order to avoid another closure, and especially to protect the safety of those who can't afford to stay home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. This entire program and individual segments can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find our stories on social media. Anna Rader is our web editor. If you have topics or ideas for future shows, you can email them through our website. And don't forget that you'll never miss an episode if you sign up for our podcast. Also, please support this program and Wyoming news coverage with your pledge. Again, you can do that at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.